My name is Michael Lane, usually known as Mike, and I live in Woodgate, a beach town in Queensland.
And I'm his wife, Jude Pippin. I kept my own name, even though we've been married for 25 years.
And today's date is the 10th of November, 2011, and we're recording with the Story Project. And I'm going to talk about my two grandfathers, who I think deserve to have something recorded about them.
So, Michael, you've got the grandfather on the Lane side and the grandfather on the McLeod side. Now, the McLeods were your mother's side of the family, and I think you'd like to start with Grandfather McLeod, because he was pretty special. What year were you born in?
I was born in 1942, and my father was away at the war. He was down in Albury pulling guns apart and putting them back together and doing all kinds of things that he hated doing, and I didn't see him or even become aware of his existence until probably I was three or something, towards the end of the war. And so very much my maternal grandfather, George John McLeod, was my father figure, role model, companion, and all sorts of other things. Now, he was called George John McLeod, and he was called by his wife, my grandmother, who was Hilda Muriel McLeod. She called him Hector. And to this day, I don't know why that is, but that's one of the family things that's lost in the mists of time and antiquity and whatever. He was a tall, thin man, balding, and he wore those kind of wire-rimmed glasses. Now, he didn't see much out of those glasses, I don't think, because they were always, well, almost always, solidly smeared with bacon fat, because he owned, ran a ham and beef shop, which I'll talk about in a minute. And I remember my father, even in later years, going into the shop and unhooking glasses off father's nose. Now, I always called him father or father, and dad going in and taking the glasses off his nose and polishing them and handing them back, and father looking surprised at how much he could see, you know. His idea of cleaning the glasses was to wipe a bacon-fatted thumb across them to try and clear some of the debris off, which didn't really work all that well.
What's one of the stories that gives you an idea of how important he was to you when you were a very small child?
Oh, well, as we are aware that the war was on, and even a small child could not not be somewhat unaware that there was soldiers and guns and shootings and all sorts of things. And so I even had my little balsa wood pistol that he'd made me, and I'd come charging into the lounge room of their dreadful old flat and sing out, "Look out, all you bloody Japs," and shoot everybody in sight, including my great-grandmother, grandmother, mother, and Auntie Molly and anybody else who was there, but I'd never shoot father. So he was special.
What are some of the other memories you've got of things you did with him while your father was away?
Well, we always used to go for a walk very early in the morning, and the walk was preceded by a big pot of tea and an enormous pile of Vegemite sandwiches. And it was from him I learnt the trick of rotating the teapot round on its base to make the leaves settle and to make the tea strong enough and so on. And we'd sit there like a couple of princes dining on Vegemite sandwiches and having several cups of tea, and then off we'd go for a walk. Now, this was in Newcastle, and the dreadful old flat that they lived in was right up on the beachfront at Newcastle. And we used to walk. He used to like to go and see what was going on, and he had mates everywhere that he'd talk to. And we'd walk often all the way down to the coal loading basin along the wharves, and we'd see ships and fishermen and people catching catfish and all sorts of things along the wharves, and then we'd walk back again, and then unfortunately it'd be time for him to go to work at the ham and beef shop, and I'd spend the rest of the day with the women. My mother, my grandmother, and my great-grandmother.
So while your dad was away, it's obvious that your mum spent a lot of time with her side of the family, and you were very closely networked with them. So what happened when your father came home from the war?
When Dad came home from the war, there was, well, firstly, he didn't get much of a reception from his three-year-old son. I've been told that I kind of looked at him and said, go away. He found that, of course, terribly hurtful, and none of them were very thoughtful about child raising or, you know, they had their own ideas about how children ought to behave, and Dad came home with a belly full of army discipline and was determined that his son was going to be raised the way he wanted him to, and he seemed to feel that my grandfather, had spoilt me rotten while he was away. And so there was a very severe diminution in the number of visits we had and how much time we spent. And I think there were some arguments too about child rearing. And I know Father used to say to him, oh, you're being too tough on the boy. I can actually remember him saying that. And I think Dad didn't take that too well. But nevertheless, that's how it was, and I didn't ever see as much of him in the intervening years as I had done in those very early years, but he remained a strong influence on my thinking and attitudes and things, I think.
Think about the ham and beef shop. You said you'd like to say a bit more about the rhythm of life at the ham and beef shop.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things about the ham and beef shop. Firstly, you say ham and beef shop to people these days, and they don't know what you mean, but it was kind of the forerunner of a deli, even though there were probably delis around as well. And they sold preserved things, smoked fish, from South Africa and kippers from Scotland and herrings and butter and cheese and corned beef and ham.
Tell us about your grandmother's special recipe for brawn.
Yeah, I'll come to that. They also sold bacon and various other of those kinds of things that you'd have on sandwiches or for breakfast or something. And my grandmother was part of this enterprise, and there was always a big pot cooking on the stove, the gas stove in the flat. The stove, I remember, was an early cooker with a kookaburra on the oven door. And she had a number of little enameled metal bowls. From memory, there must have been two dozen or 30 of those bowls. And in this great pot on the stove would be cooking pig's cheeks and I don't know what all else, but things that go to make brawn, and this would be done every day. All these little metal bowls that were the size of a dessert bowl would be set out on a big board that went across the bath in the bathroom. I mean, you think about workplace health and safety now, they would have had a fit, but it was all clean. And the brawn would be the cooked liquid, and meat would be put into these little bowls and left there to set overnight. And then the next morning, a man from a carrying company would come and take all those down to the shop, and they'd be demoulded from the little bowls, and they'd be sent back for a refill, and the brawn would be sliced and sold in the shop. And one of my regrets is I was not smart enough to get the recipe for that brawn, because it was quite famous throughout Newcastle, and my grandmother did offer to give it to me, but I wasn't old enough to take that on board, so that passed.
One of the photos that I really love of you and your grandfather, McLeod, he's holding a fishing line. He's got his fishing hat on and his glasses, and you're standing there as just close to him. So what do you remember about his connection with fishing?
Oh, he was a great fisherman, and a beach fisherman mainly. He caught a lot of fish, and didn't have a lot of fishing gear. He had some sinker moulds and fishing rods and lines and things, and a green cane fishing basket, which I still have in my possession. He used to fish on the beaches around the north end of Newcastle. I think he talked to me about fishing, and he did bequeath to me his wonderful scrapbook of fishing, which was a big day-to-a-page business diary covered in full of newspaper cuttings and photographs and notes and diagrams and things. And unfortunately, it disappeared from the family home while I was away in New Guinea, and it was never found, much to my regret.
What about the model boats he used to make?
Yeah, he was a model maker as well, and he used to make a lot of ship models out of balsa wood and string and sinkers and washers and things. And also he was a great one for using the plywood off the side of the cheese and butter boxes that came to the shop. And he produced some lovely model ships from galleons down to steamers and liners and things, most of which he presented to me after he'd made them and got sick of them. He was a great one for doing that.
How old were you when your grandfather McLeod died?
I think I was about 11.
What do you remember about that time?
Not much. I was not taken to visit him in hospital. I do know that he perished from a kidney disease or a kidney problem that these days would have been fixed very, very easily. So I didn't get to see him in hospital, and nor did I get to go to the funeral. This was the kind of time when it was thought that children should be protected from these kind of things. And so, he was just no longer there. I should also mention some other things about him. As I said earlier, he was a veteran of the First World War. He'd fought with the number 34 Battalion AIF in France. He was a signaller and spent quite a bit of time under fire running telephone lines across battlefields. He was on the Somme. He had a network of veteran friends. And I did a number of times march with him in the Anzac Day March in Newcastle when I was very small, and then later on after he died and I was in the Air Training Corps, the Air Force Cadets, I turned up for the march and the old diggers said, "Oh, put him in there, that's Mac's boy." And I was very taken with that. The family was pretty poor. I think when he died, there was no money. And that was largely because he was a very, very generous man, and any of his mates could turn up with a hard luck story and get a quid, a pound, which was a lot of money in those days. And the feeling was that none of it was ever paid back. But as I said, he had a lot of mates. He was a bowler. He bowled at the National Park Bowling Club in Newcastle, and he was quite a good bowler. His one day of the year to let his hair down was Anzac Day, and he'd go out in the morning with his medals on his chest and come home with them pinned to the back of his coat, and very much the worse for wear. But other than that, he led a quiet life and was home in the evenings, listening to the radio serials, and working on the kitchen table, making models and talking to me. And the flat that they lived in, while it was these days would have been considered a prime piece of real estate, was an awful place. There was a cupboard at the end of the end of the kitchen, which if you opened had some shelves in it, and the back of the cupboard was the living rock that the building was built against. When the wind blew from the south, the bedroom carpet and the lounge room carpet used to lift in kind of waves as the wind blew up through the cracks in the floorboards. It was reached down a very narrow, dank passageway that smelt of cats and was always grubby. And the stone doorstep was worn away from generations of cooks sharpening their knives on it. It was a piece of slate that you'd squat down and sharpen your knife on before you chopped up the vegetables. There was something else I wanted to mention too. Can we pause there? Just to go back to that flat, that awful flat had a magnificent ocean view. You looked out the lounge room and the bathroom and the bedroom windows onto Shelley Beach, which is between the old Newcastle Baths and Nobby's Beach, and you looked out there onto a vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean, exactly where the Japanese sub rose out of the water and shelled Newcastle. And the night the Japanese sub shelled Newcastle, my grandparents, my grandmother, and somebody else, great aunt or somebody, were at the window looking out, and they said, "Oh, they're having fireworks, look at that," as a star shell from the sub went up. And then of course there was a shell landed on the promenade, as they called it, down below the road that ran around the beach. and exploded, and they both finished up flat on their backs in the lounge room. Now, at this stage, my grandfather had taken on the duties of an air raid warden, and I remember the blue and white warden, no, it was black and yellow, a black and yellow sign on the gate to the laneway which said warden on it, and that was him. And he was out that night rushing around helping people and organising things, wearing his tin hat. And amazingly, he actually appears in Eleanor Dark's book, Southern Steel, as one of the two wardens who are keeping people away from a shell crater at the end of their street, which was Beach Street, amazingly, in Newcastle. So, yes, father never owned a piece of property in his life. My father, who was associated with building societies, several times offered to assist him to purchase a place, but he wouldn't make that leap. He didn't want to owe anybody anything. And that provides a contrast with my other grandfather, Frederick William Lane, and that's spelt L-E-A-N and pronounced Lane. And Pop, as I called him, which he decided he didn't like in later years and preferred to be called grandfather, but he was always Pop to me. He helped a lot of people into houses because he was the founder of the Greater Newcastle Permanent Building Society, and you'll see signs around now that say The Greater, and you've got American television stars advertising The Greater. That was him. He started that whole thing from scratch. And also a number of other societies that you don't hear so much about these days, which are the Starbucket societies. These were an American idea of a cooperative savings and loan operation where you became a member and your loan came up through a ballot and you got a certain period of interest-free lending, and they really went very well in Newcastle. And they're called Starbucket societies because they were invented or developed by a Mr. Star and a Mr. Bocut, who were Americans.
Now, your relationship with Grandfather Lane was different from that of Grandfather McLeod. How would you describe the quality of the relationship with Grandfather Lane?
Yeah, it was a very, very formal relationship. None of my family, either which way, were... I shouldn't say that about the great aunts, but we're not talking about them. Nobody was very touchy-feely or huggy-kissy. But Pop was very, very formal and quite stern. He didn't laugh a lot. He took things pretty seriously. When I was very, very small, just a baby in a shawl, you know, not mobile at all, he was apparently left in charge of me at a picnic and put me on a car seat and then a thermos full of hot tea or hot water came open and spilt on me, and I was seriously ill with burns for some time, and I don't know the ins and outs of that, but he certainly didn't do it on purpose, but he felt very, very guilty about it for a long time afterwards, and I think he was very, very cautious around me.
Would you like to describe him? What was he like physically?
He was a tall man too. He was a bit a bit fuller in the figure than my other grandfather, but had a full head of snow white hair, and as I said, was always very formal, even when he was gardening, and he was a great gardener. He grew the most magnificent tomatoes on the vacant block next door to his house in Hamilton. Even when he was gardening, he would wear a collar and tie and long pants of the, you know, dark pinstripe variety. The interesting thing was that those pants were kept up with an old tie, an old necktie used as a belt. And my mother was always trying to buy him a nice belt, and he didn't want a nice belt. He was totally happy with his tie, and I've since read that that's a feature of Englishmen do that a lot, use their old suits for gardening and keep their pants up with an old necktie. He came from a very, very poor share farming family who were never ever very successful. They came originally from Cornwall, and he would have been fourth generation because I'm sixth generation in Australia. The family has always, the male head of the family has always been a justice of the peace, and that's run right through Dad and myself. But he did it tough when he was a kid. He they walked some terrible distance to school. I mean, it sounds a bit like some of that Monty Python stuff about, you know, living under a piece of cardboard and eating gravel for breakfast, but they did walk miles to school and miles home, and then had to do farm labouring jobs, Pop and his sisters and brothers, and then they all got around the table, and there was only one hurricane lamp in the house, and that's when they did their homework, by the light of a hurricane lamp. And eventually he got a job with the post office, or Postmaster General's Department, as it was then. And eventually he served time as postmaster at various post offices around the New England area, but also a bit further afield. He was the postmaster at Stockinbingle. He was postmaster at Uralla. And he was also postmaster at the place where Dad was born, which I can't remember the life of me. I've got that plate at home. A popular cafe. It's down south, Snowy Mountains area. Anyway, it was around there during that time that he became interested in the cooperative movement and the Starbucket societies and building societies and so on. And he obtained permission from the chief engineer of the Postmaster General's Department in Newcastle to actually take some time off and go and study how these societies and things worked. I don't know where he did that. I should also add that interspersed with all this work and study, he suffered from tuberculosis, and he spent quite a bit of time away from the family in a sanatorium, I think in the Blue Mountains somewhere, but I'm not sure about that. He eventually overcame that and was cured.
He lived to a ripe old age.
He did. He lived until he was 96, and he was completely compos mentis right up until the last couple of weeks.
The When you came back, you had 18 years or so in New Guinea.
15
years in New Guinea. When you came back from New Guinea, did you find that there was any difference in the relationship with your grandfather?
Oh, yes. He was much more relaxed. He was a staunch Labor man, and he knew that my political leanings were in that direction too. And we had many points of agreement, and we could talk about the prime ministers and politicians whom we mutually admired and the ones who we mutually held a lot of distaste for. I'd like to finish just talking about the building society side of things. He eventually called a meeting and got a lot of interested people, and the early savings and loan societies and Starbucket societies were formed, and that was on the eve of the Great Depression in the 1930s. And things were pretty tough, but Pop kept his societies going all through the Depression, and none of his investors lost any money at all. Everything was kept intact all through that period, and the organisation went on to grow to the thing that it is today, the Greater Newcastle Permanent Building Society, which has provided home loans for thousands and thousands and thousands of people. He was greatly respected by the migrant communities of the 1950s, particularly the Greeks and the Turks, who didn't have a great deal of time for each other, but he could move between those two communities, and they actually used him as a broker of peace at various times. And some of the Christmas presents and cards that would arrive for him around Christmas time from people that he'd helped with housing were just amazing. You know, he'd get these great Greek cakes would be delivered from Mrs. Papadopoulos up at Musselbrook or something, you know, because she'd been helped to get a house and so on.
Do you remember anything about his passing?
No, I wasn't there. I should mention also that he was a very staunch Anglican. He was a member of the Diocesan Synod and a church warden of the St. Peter's Church in Hamilton. So he had very strong associations with the Anglican Church. He had two children, my father, Ivan, and my aunt, Laura. And his wife was Mabel Daisy Hawkins, who came from the New England area. And there are still lots of them up there. They were tin miners and continued that Cornish tradition. Just on that name, the L-E-A-N pronounced Lane has been researched by a lot of people in the family, in the very, very extended family, people that I've corresponded with on the internet. And it is a Celtic name, and they're quite satisfied that the correct pronunciation is Lane and not Lean.
Is it because it is part of the old MacLean?
No,
not related to that?
Not, doesn't seem to be that at all. There is a great family tradition that the Lanes appeared in Cornwall after two sons of the chief of the clan, MacLean, rebelled against their father during a battle and were kicked out of the clan and had to drop the Mac from their names. Now, if you rebel against your father in the middle of a battle, they tend to chop your head off rather than just expel you from the clan, but that's the story. Allegedly, one of these brothers went to Edinburgh and I think the words of the story are he left the trail a mile wide and drank himself to death. And the other one went to Cornwall and settled there. And there are parish records in Cornwall as early as the late 1600s. But nobody's ever really nailed that one down, although the story is right throughout Lane families around the world, as I've learnt by corresponding with people on the net. So it may be that we have Scottish on both sides, from the MacLeans and the MacLeods, or it might be just Scottish on one side from the MacLeods, and the Lanes remain part of the Celtic organisation, but maybe it's not Scottish. We don't know. My father used to describe us as that great Irish rabble, which had nothing to do with anything. And I shouldn't let this opportunity go past without recording a couple of father's favourite expressions. Anybody who was out of line was a rat bag, which I still employ myself. And his other expression, which I've always liked and never used, if somebody was annoying him, he'd say, "I'll fix his clock," which I thought was great. Pop didn't have any of those expressions, but I should also record that he was very kind to me a couple of times when I got myself into some trouble that I don't want to go into any great details about, but he was more than understanding and fished me out of something that could have been much more unpleasant than it was. And in later years, we exchanged letters quite a lot. And that was nice. That was just nice to get a letter from your grandfather talking about things that were of interest to both of us and nobody else. So I have good memories of both of those two gentlemen.